So I'm glad to say it got a proper author, you know, someone of stature, which makes a lovely change for this podcast.
Brian McLaren, he's annoyingly good with words, isn't he? I find that quite irritating.
But I tell you what, though, this is true of you and Brian McLaren, I think. I genuinely mean this. You have both got better the more you have written. I feel like his last few books have been his best. And I feel very similar about your last few books. They have been outstandingly good. So there's something about keeping at it, isn't there?
But I've got a new article out on wisdom, so I think that may refute your theory about getting better.
Really? But you're the wisest person I know. Surely it's brilliant.
Welcome, everybody, to episode 200 and something of the Mid-Faith Crisis podcast. 83?
He's trying to say 200. Yeah. I mean, the clue is right in front of you on the running order where I wrote it.
Yeah, but I haven't got that open at the moment.
Oh.
I've looked at it now. Episode 283 of the Mid-Faith Crisis podcast. My name's Nick Page, and I've annoyed Joe Davis.
Well,
there he is.
I'm in deep prayer, honestly.
Are you? Anyway. Is that what that looks like? I wonder.
Anyway, that was a momentary depression brought on by you because, hey, we've got a great interview coming up. So that's good.
Yeah. Brian McLaren, we're going to be interviewing him. Well, I say we are. You, in fact, have interviewed him on his new book, Life After Doom.
Yeah.
Which sounds a bundle of laughs.
Well,
really.
Exactly. Yeah, I don't think there are lots of laughs in this book, and certainly a lot less laughs than in any of your books to date.
Well, yes, perhaps though that's where I've been going wrong.
Yeah.
Who knows?
But it is a book full of wisdom and wise words on the theme of wisdom. So so that's great. We shall enjoy it. I don't think there's much coming up, is there, at the moment? You know, you've got your article out.
Yes. So I've done an article on how to be, it's called How to Be Wise, Confessions of a Recovering Idiot. And it's on out in Christianity Magazine. And there is a link. I will put the link in the show notes. We will talk about it next week.
Great.
When enough time has passed between me and Brian McLaren to not make the comparison seem awful. Okay. So that we'll do that next week. Other than that, no, because we only spoke end of last week, because we're recording this a bit in advance because I've got stuff on this week. So there isn't a great deal of news and not much has happened, really. Have you got any notices, church notices?
Not really. Well, actually, I mean, kind of. There's one. So this Sunday at 8:30 a.m, I'm going to be leading just a little meditative walk, probably for myself. But if anyone else turns up, it's going to be on the Nepa State at 8:30 in the morning this Sunday. What's this date this Sunday? I don't even know. Is it going to be the 5th of May? And I'm sort of calling it In Search of the Cuckoo or The Sound of the Cuckoo. It's just a wonderful, heartening time in spring where you hear the first cuckoo. And the Nepa State has many cuckoos there, I hope, by now, having flown in from the continent. So we're listen, we're walk, we're pause, we're consider our one wild life together, as Mary Oliver would have said. And then, I don't know, we'll have breakfast or something. I don't know. But, you know, that's happening on Sunday at 8:30.
If there's no sort of obvious cuckoos, is plan B to have Rachel with one of those, like a,
yeah,
sort of bird caller whistles thing?
Yeah, I know.
She's, yeah, Swanee, yeah, whistle behind a bush.
She's behind a bush en route. Oh, listen! Let us give thanks.
And then, strangely, the cuckoo will start to do worship songs as well. It'd be amazing.
And someone will say, that cuckoo sounds a little bit like a clanger. And I'll have to say, shush.
And we'll put a link in the show notes for our overseas listeners as to what the clangers were. You haven't lived until you've heard the clangers, I tell you. Anyway, we should get on because we've got an interview. So set us up with this interview. This is Brian McLaren talking about his latest book.
Yeah, I mean, the book is called Life After Doom, Wisdom and Courage for a World Falling Apart. I mean, I don't even know how much he wanted to write this book, but it just seems so relevant. His working theory, and I think I like it, is that before you can live hopefully and joyfully, you can't really live in denial because you always know there's stuff there. So what he's wanting to encourage us to do is face the facts kind of head on. You know, the world is in a serious situation. there's a lot going on. But actually, if you are brave enough to walk into that darkness, as we've said in so many ways before, actually there's life after doom. So that's the premise of the book. Brian is as lovely as he's ever been. He's a very dear man. He does, of course, mention the title of the podcast, and I love that he did. And I wish I'd spent more time with him. You know, he mentions air travel at one point. I thought, oh, I should have said, what do you do about air travel? Because I know he's concerned about all this stuff. But, you know, I kind of just let him roll. He's good value. And I certainly hope that you will all enjoy this.
Well, dear friends, I'm delighted to welcome back to the Mid-Faith Crisis podcast our very dear friend, Brian McLaren. Brian, welcome back.
So I'm happy to be back. And can I just say, I love the name of your podcast. I think it's a great name.
I know you do. And I love that you love it. It's so good to see you. You know, we're British. We don't do big introductions and
that's
all
good.
That sort of thing, like you guys in the US do.
But, oh, my gosh.
I will just say, though, that what I have loved about your writings through the years, and this goes for Rachel, my wife, as well, is you always seem to be just a few steps ahead of us, not too far ahead, but ahead enough for us to, you know, understand what you're saying. And it's lovely when some, you know, when an author articulates better than you ever could exactly how you're feeling. It's just such a beautiful thing, right? And, you know, and the past few books, I mean, you have been knocking it out of the park as far as I'm concerned. So thank you for your writings. And I'm thrilled to talk about this new book, Life After Doom. But before we get going, just tell us a bit about yourself, because you're now working with the Center for Contemplation and Action. What's going on in your life at the moment?
Yes, well, I continue to write, and you know, there's lots of causes I'm committed to, and I do still do some public speaking. But a few years ago, I was contacted by the Center for Action and Contemplation, which Richard Rohr founded, Franciscan monk. I highly recommend the daily meditation that they send out. And Richard and I have been friends for about 25 years, and he's in his 80s, and he's survived an amazing series of health challenges. And they were smart enough to say, we need to start planning ahead for, you know, for the long-term future of the organization. So they invited me to get involved and join a wonderful faculty. And then I was asked to become the dean, which means I'm trying to build a strong faculty and help the CAC look forward to a vital future, because that integration of action and contemplation, change in the world outside of us requiring change in the world inside of us. That to me is what we need. So I'm honored to do that work.
Well, and we are so thrilled you are. And, you know, it feels like the CAC is in safe hands. So bless you, mate. Thank you for that. And, you know, just love their work. And like you say, love the daily meditations that we get. Thank you. The last two books, before we move on, Faith After Doubt. We talked about that, and I think one of the ongoing themes of our podcast is, you know, what does that harmony stage? We start with simplicity, we move to complexity and perplexity, and I guess all our listeners are very familiar with those kind of stages. But how do we move through that, and what does harmony look like? I think we're just kind of trying to figure that out. And I think one of the things that's hard is it looks very different.
Yes.
For every one of us, actually. It's not, we're not one homogenous unit.
Yes.
We love one another and we accept one another. And, you know, but yeah.
That's right. You know, and there's a certain sense that in simplicity, we're all soldiers following some army and general, and there's a certain amount of uniformity. I think the farther we go, in some ways, the more diversity there is, partly because part of maturity is being able to acknowledge that people are at different stages in their own development, and they're in different contexts that call forth different things for them. And we all have different histories that give us different wounds and scars and strengths and capacity. So, but you know, something that that has helped me in the years since Faith After Doubt came out, and being in so many conversations with people about their own spiritual journey, I think there are two main ways that people move into that harmony stage. I think there are many ways, but two main categories. First, I think there are people who move in because they discover a love that is so big and so deep that it just creates a new order for their lives. Right. A friend of mine, Mirabai Starr, who's a lovely writer of Jewish background, Mirabai says, once you discover the God of love, you fire all your other gods.
Yeah, I just love that's that. Great, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah, that's that. Brilliant. That is
absolutely... So I think love draws some people, but I think another factor for other people is when you spend years engaging in critical thinking, maybe we'd even say skepticism, maybe we'd even say cynicism. When you become skeptical of your own skepticism and cynical about your own cynicism, in a certain sense, that forces you to say, what could be beyond this? Because I don't want to stay here anymore.
Yeah. And
those two things together, I think, are what help us move into that next stage, which is full of growth and challenges and change and all the rest.
No, I love it. And then after that book, you wrote, I think, a really, I don't know how to describe it, gutsy. Do you have that word in America? A real gutsy book called Do I Stay Christian? And I say gutsy because when you finished a section that said no, I was convinced. I was convinced no one is going to stay Christian after they read that lot. You went through the history of the church and some of the awful things that have happened in Christ's name. And but then you came out of that and said, you know, if everyone leaves the church, there's no dissenting voices. There can be no change, no movement, no evolution of the church. Yeah. And you talked about something, a name which I have stolen gratuitously, I have credited you, called Staying Defiant. Yeah. And I've done a few Zooms with a dear friend who's a Baptist pastor, who I think you know, Dave Steele, who's based in Brighton. And and we've done a few things around this theme of staying defiantly. How do we do that? Yeah. And it looks like that's going to become an ever greater thing as the Baptist church tears itself apart. And I know other denominations are going through it at the moment. So, staying defiantly, there's a lot of us around here that plan to do that, but we need hope.
Yes.
And yes. We appreciate the help that you've given us in that. We really do, Brian.
Thank you.
I feel like most of us are in a certain degree of denial, Brian, because we all desperately need some hope, but it's hard to look at the world and feel hopeful. And I haven't read your book cover to cover yet, but on page 28, you do say there is life after doom, but first you have to face the doom. So I wonder whether you could set the scene for this next book. What do you see going on in the world? Set some context for us.
Okay. Gladly, Joe. Look, all of our brains evolved to give us the amount of data we need to survive another day, right? Yeah. And our brains have features that we call biases that actually screen out reality that we either don't want to face or don't have the energy to face. And a lot of us can, and another word for those biases is denial. We have the ability to shut out things that we don't want to face.
Yeah.
And it's in all of us. Sometimes it's denial about the world. Sometimes it's denial about ourselves, but we have this capacity for denial. And a lot of us, I think, reach a point where we're exercising so much energy. We're expending so much energy to deny so much that we begin to feel fatigued. We think there is a backlog of reality that I'm not facing.
Yeah.
And I think it's exhausting me more to not face it than it would be to face it. I think we've gone through this as parents where we see problems for our children. We think it'll work out, it'll work. Yeah. But then we think, you know what, this, I can't just push this off. Or it might be in our marriage, or it might be in our church. But I think there's this backlog of denied reality that we're facing, that literally billions of us are facing. And that basically has to do with how we're living with the earth and with one another. The way we're living with the earth, ecologists call it overshoot. We're sucking out more resources than the earth can replenish, and we're pumping out more toxins than the earth can detoxify. And that's suicidal. We just can't do that forever. And we've been doing it for so long and so rapidly, with a rapidly growing population, that's one part of reality that we can't hold at bay anymore. And then another part of reality is that we have conflicts and tensions with each other as individuals, as political parties, as nations, as religions, as races. We have all this conflict with people. And we have created weapons of greater and greater kill power. When you put those two problems, that we're not living well with the planet and we don't know how to live well with each other, then you start to think, if things get worse for the planet, if the environment gets more destabilized, every human conflict will be intensified. We had a decade of disruption globally, when about 1 million refugees from Syria and other areas of the Middle East needed a new place to live. What happens when it's 10 million? What happens when it's 100 million? And we're facing the possibility of tens and hundreds of millions of climate refugees in the next 40 or 50 years. So imagine the stress that will cause. We went through a pandemic where our supply chains were disrupted. What happens when they're disrupted even more significantly because of climate change related things and ecological stress? And so more and more people are realizing that the external environment, political, social, and biological, right, that external environment is sufficiently destabilized, then our internal environment, our nervous systems become destabilized. And then that creates all kinds of issues. And more of us are saying, I've got to face it, and I've got to learn how to manage my own reactions to it if I want to show up well in the years to come.
Yeah. So to summarize that, here's how I see it, Brian. Yes. We're on the verge of the next mass extinction. We're all going to die due to the climate if we haven't killed each other in war beforehand. Thanks for listening, everyone. Have a great day.
Yeah, that's right. So I think what you just said is possible. And I think we have to admit that it's possible. One of the main contributions I hope the book makes is that I offer four scenarios that I think are ahead for us. It might be helpful if I just
Would you talk us through them? Thank you.
The first, so what you said a minute ago, somewhat tongue in cheek, but also.
It's not. I think the Anthropocene has had it.
That's right. But here's one way to say it. We don't have an environmental problem. The environment has a human problem. And what we don't understand is when we destabilize the environment, it hurts us because we are part of it. I think of it this way. Every time I take a breath, my left lung gets oxygen from the rainforests of the Amazon and the other great rainforests of the world. My right lung gets oxygen from plankton in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. So like every breath I take, I'm breathing in oxygen that the earth provides for me, that other living creatures provide for me. I mean, it's amazing. It's almost a mystical experience when you feel how connected we are. Every time we eat, you know, we're taking in processed sunlight from other living creatures. It's amazing. When we destabilize that, our civilization will collapse before the environment will totally collapse. In other words, it will only take a little bit of destabilization in the environment to make the Jenga tower of our civilization collapse.
Yeah.
And so the four scenarios are related to civilizational collapse. The first is collapse avoidance, that somehow we manage to avoid collapse. The second is collapse rebirth, that we will have a collapse, but we will gain sufficient wisdom that we can rebuild something after it. The third is collapse survival, that there will be a collapse. Some number of us, probably less than 10% of our current population, let's say less than 20 and maybe 10%, would survive, but we would not survive in a way that could restore what we might call civilization. So it would be surviving at a kind of pre-modern state. And then the fourth is collapse extinction. And the terrible thing about collapse extinction is that when we humans, if we create enough destruction to take us out, we will take out an awful lot of the rest of the biosphere. So those are the four scenarios. And I think everyone's first reaction is, well, collapse avoidance, let's hope we can go for that. And I'd say, yeah, except we ought to keep this in mind. Let's say that we buy 250 more years of avoiding collapse, but we don't deal with the deeper problem, which is how we live with the earth and how we live with one another. If we do that, then the collapse that happens 250 years from now is far more catastrophic, you know? So all that's to say, we're like teenagers who've been snorting too much cocaine and driving too fast in our cars and not getting enough sleep. And we're going to do permanent health damage unless we grow up as a species. Sure.
Okay. That's a good metaphor. Thank you. We get it. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So in your book, you've broken things down into four sections.
Yes.
Letting go, a path of descent. Letting be, a place of insight. Letting come, a path of resilience. Setting free, a path of agile engagement. I wonder if you can sort of begin to talk us through what you were trying to get at under those kind of headings.
So, you know, those four headings create a kind of U-shaped curve where there's a descent, a dwelling at the bottom, and then an ascent.
Okay.
And you know, this matches what in a lot of spiritual traditions, in Christianity, for example, we would call the Paschal mystery of death, burial, resurrection. But that first path of descent that I call letting go, and other people have called it letting go as well, is letting go of our illusions, letting go of our denial, letting go of our view of the world as we wish it were, and become more and more ready to face the world as it is. The letting be can only happen after we've had our illusions painfully stripped away from us. And maybe I could just give an example of an illusion. I have, you know, been raised, you know, we're in the same general decade of life. Our whole life has been during a period of economic expansion and economic growth. And I assumed that could become normative, that kind of growth could go on forever. Maybe not forever, but I thought it could go on forever as far as I'm concerned for my 70 or 80 or 90 years of life. But now I've come to realize that economic growth was fueled by fossil fuels. And fossil fuels were like a bank of energy that we discovered buried, like buried treasure. And we've been outspending all the buried treasure. And now we're realizing we can't keep spending that buried treasure. If we spend it all, we will go extinct, because we'll raise the temperature of the earth maybe 7 degrees centigrade or more, which will just be absolutely catastrophic for the entire planet as we living planet as we know it. So I thought that there was almost a guarantee that we had baked progress in. to reality. If you'd asked me, I would have said, no, I don't think that. But I did think it on some deep level.
Yeah.
And writing this book, what I've come to realize is that was an illusion. That was that was a capitalism-induced, fossil fuel-induced illusion. And when you take away fossil fuels and you take away the illusions of capitalism, you realize that's just not, I have not been seeing reality. That's what we mean by letting be. When for just a while, we give ourselves permission to blink and look around and say, what really is going on here? One other quick example. It has been true since I was born that money rules the world. But I did not want to face that. And something that happens when you say, we have this existential crisis, we have to change our whole economy to a regenerative economy. And you realize we're not doing it. We know we need to do it. The scientists are screaming. The scientists are, you know, protesting. When scientists get out in the street protesting, you know it's serious, right?
Yeah.
They like to
yeah.
be left alone in their labs with their data. and yet, and we're taking small actions, but they're a pittance compared to what needs to be taken. And then you realize, oh, this is because the world is ruled by money. So then letting be is just giving yourself a chance to say, what's really going on here? Now, something happens if you marinate in that stew of letting be, which can be painful. It's disruptive,
for sure.
Right?
Yeah.
There's loss, but something begins to come. Okay, now I know what reality is. A friend of mine who has been reading the manuscript for the book said, gosh, this is intense. How are you holding up? And I said, I said, it's strange, but I feel a deep, deep joy. And I said, I think the joy of facing reality is hard to explain. Even if the reality is painful, there is a relief at feeling like at least I'm trying to face it, right? So that's part of what comes in the letting come, a new motivation. For me, as I explain in the book, I had some real discoveries of what is the kind of motivation I want going forward. That's the letting come. And then the setting free is saying, okay, with what has come to me now, I'm free to carry on with my life, but in a new way. So that's the four stages: letting go, letting come, setting free.
And that feels a lot like the sort of harmony stage of the stages of faith as well. That sort of coming to terms with radical acceptance. I think, I mean, I haven't read that section yet. I cannot wait. I genuinely can't, because, you know, I don't know how you feel about this to be present, but, you know, you've only got to say the word Trump. And we have the equivalents over here. You can feel it's visceral in your body. Yes. You can feel your heart. My heart sinks. I know that's not everyone's experience. Other views are available. I understand that. But my heart sinks at that, because it feels like there is mass denial. There's political denial of the realities that you're talking about in this book. And therefore, there is an utter unwillingness. They will stir up a fervor and a fever to make our, you know, whatever country it is, fill in the blank, great again. Let's go back to those happy days when we just raped the earth of all its resources. Let's go back to those good times when progress was, you know, the number one thing. So I think the question here I want to ask you is, understanding reality, and it's pretty ugly, if we're honest, do you think it is possible to live joyfully and happily? We've already answered. You said that, you know, when you answered a friend and said, I feel a sense of joy. But do you think it is? And can you say anything to anyone now as to what are the keys you have found to live joyfully within this context?
Yes. Well, first, let's make a distinction. The world of birds and trees and rivers and mountains and soil and photosynthesis, that world is awesome. One of my little mantras that I say to myself is, humans are a mess, but the birds are being awesome. The trees are, the humans are a disaster. The trees are being awesome. So one of the things that helps me have joy is that I remember that the trees are being awesome. That, you know, the climate doesn't have a humans don't have a climate problem. The climate has a human problem, right? So the problem is with humans. So then if I can separate and say, we're the anomaly, like human civilization is like that grubby, mean-spirited, dangerous neighborhood where this species is causing trouble for everybody else. And, you know, can I just say, one of the things that we have to realize is our footprint on the earth, like we have reduced the amount of wild animals by an amount equal to or greater than the biomass of all the cows, pigs, chickens, you know, goats, sheep that we humans have raised. Like we've replaced wildlife with human food production, right? So our impact is just huge, but the earth itself is still beautiful. But then we just look at human beings. I was on an airplane 2 days ago, and I'm walking through the airport, and I see mothers and fathers loving their children. And I see, I was going down the aisle of the airplane, and there was a mother with a special needs son, and his needs were extreme. And I thought, she has loved this boy. You know, he's probably 17 years old. For 17 years, she's nurtured this boy, and she's being so kind to him on this plane. Like, I almost got tears in my eyes walking down the aisle. There's so much love there. And I sat down next to somebody. We get into conversation, the sweetest, nicest person, right? So when you look around, most human beings are decent people, you know? And it's hard to hate them. And then you realize, okay, suddenly something that a lot of us will remember from the Bible, when Paul spoke of principalities and powers, our enemies aren't flesh and blood people. Our enemy are these ways of thinking, these principalities, these systems of power. That's what principality means, a system of power. And in fact, a principality is where power passes from the father to the son, the king to the prince. It's the system of patriarchy. You know, that's what Paul is talking about, right? And so we look and we say, oh, these are our problems. So that's a long windup to say this. In the letting go phase and in the letting be phase, here's what I think can happen for us. If we imagine our lives being entangled with all of the assumptions of a capitalist global civilization, and we start to realize this capitalist global situation will surely destroy us, then we have to say, if I want to survive, I have to untangle myself from this capitalist this capitalist system of exploitation and domination and so on. And we have to imagine over time, because it'll take a lot of time, a billion or a couple billion of us being willing to make that kind of disentanglement. And when we do that, we think, you know, there are other ways to live. We don't have to live this way. We can have a good life in many other ways. And then I think new possibilities open. And there's a joy at realizing human beings are not only stuck being human beings in the way we currently are.
That's,
you know,
great.
To me, there's a kind of good news to that. You know what I'm saying? That I wouldn't be surprised if that's what Jesus and Paul were after, you know?
For sure. Now, listen, how are you, having written the book now, how are you wanting people to use it? What do you think are the wise ways to go about reading it? So that doesn't seem a strange question.
Well, I have a disclaimer, as you know, in the introduction, and I just say, look, this book isn't for everybody. If you're under a whole lot of stress and you feel like you're on the edge right now, you know, come back to this book some other time. You deal with what you've got to deal with, right? But for those of us who are ready to deal with it, we know we need to deal with it. We're ready. I think a person could read, I know a person could read it alone and gain a lot of benefit, but about two thirds of the way through the, or a little past halfway through the book, I have a chapter, it only takes two or three. And I think what would be ideal is if someone starts the book and they think, I know a couple other people who are struggling with this too. I think it would really be a benefit to read it together.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is that when it feels like the world is falling apart, and when you see the Trumps, and we won't mention any British names.
But oh, you can if you want. Rishi Sunak. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, they're all around. They're let me just say it plainly. They are stupid people who know how to get attention, power, votes, and money.
Well, tell us what you really think, bro.
but they're stupid. I don't mean that even as an insult. It's like they're people who don't face reality. They're people who are ignorant. They're people who don't read anything that doesn't help them do what they want to do. You understand that?
That
is your way of becoming a fool. When you only are interested in what you want, you're a fool, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of fools are ruling the world now. And we have to... It's true. We're fooling ourselves if we don't say that. When we face that fact and see their power, we will go absolutely bonkers if we don't find two or three people with whom we can create a little island of sanity.
Yeah.
And I have a feeling that's what Jesus meant when he said, two or three of you gather. I think he's saying you can create a little island of sanity. You'll feel my presence. You will feel you're part of something.
You know, I know this is true because it's exactly what we did at Soul Place for We Make the Road by Walking. And others, you know, listeners to our podcast have written in and said, you know, we found that book so helpful as we met together to gather. And yes, it is transformative and it does give hope. And I hope, I mean, my immediate sense, the way you'd written was really important because you've done enough chapters and they're not too long that you can read them together in a group. Yeah. There's time to do that in an evening and there's time to reflect on it and there's time to ask questions of it. And I would always say there's time to have a nice meal together as well, because that's very important. genuinely, that's such a helpful thing, because if you write a book with, you know, 50-page long chapters and everything, you've blown that out of the water. So thanks for writing that. And I want to say to the listeners, this really is a great book for your groups to use together. I really think it is. And thank you for writing it that way. You've already answered this a bit, but what do you hope people will do having read the book? What will be the impact? What's your hope?
Yeah. So when I wrote the book, you know, I know that people are looking for the plan. Like, what's the plan? And when I wrote this book way back in 2007 called Everything Must Change. And it was my first attempt to really grapple with global crises, global problems. And I knew back then that the environmental problem was huge. And if it weren't addressed immediately, you know, we would cross a bunch of tipping points. So in the years since then, I've been invited to all kinds of gatherings around the world, literally. And anytime I would get there, I would find the most knowledgeable person I could, and I would bribe them with a meal or a beer or something. And I'd say, who has the plan? Who has the plan? And I eventually realized that there is no plan. And it's not because people are lazy. It's because the system is too complex and nobody has the power to organize the plan yet. Maybe things will get bad enough and will change enough that will be possible. But right now, instead of a plan, what we need is to know how we want to show up.
Right.
Because we don't have the power to, there are so many powerful people involved, right? We have to exercise our power to show up. two ways we can show up that really make a difference. First is we got to show up to vote, and we've got to show up to vote for the kinds of the best options that we have. And we have to refuse to vote based on self-interest, especially the idiocy of individual economic interest. If you vote only on the politician that will make you the most money in the short run, you are a sorry cause. You're not thinking about the well-being of your children, the well-being of your grandchildren. Yeah. You are a pathetic human being if you only vote based on your economic self-interest. We just got to say it. I wish every priest and pastor in the world would say that.
I think you're getting feistier the older you get now. I love it.
Oh, my gosh. Well, it's just, it's just like crazy. It's crazy. So we have to vote. And if we can't find good candidates, the bar is very low to be the best candidate in the race.
Yeah.
Now, we all know there's money and all other things that complicate it, but especially local elections, more and more of us could decide to run. But at any rate, vote. Second thing is talk. I love how a friend of mine says it. You have to exercise your right to not remain silent. So what that means for me is that when I hear someone say something outrageous, hurtful, bigoted, ignorant, instead of just gritting my teeth and saying, we're doomed, I have learned to just say, wow, I see that differently. Now, almost always when I say that, then people will say, what do you mean by that? And then I'll say, I don't really need to go into it now. If you're interested, give me a call or shoot me an email. I'll be glad to talk to you in private about it. Because if there are other people around, if I argue with him or her, the other person's ego will engage to defend themselves. They'll feel I'm attacking them, and then I'll get defensive, and then it'll just be ego against ego. And that doesn't take us to a better place.
Yeah.
So exercise your right to not remain silent. And you know, it's as easy also as someone says, how are you doing? And say, do you really want to know? or how are you doing? It's complicated. And then they say, well, what do you mean? Do you really want to know? Well, the birds are being awesome, but human beings are a mess, and we need to find a new way to live, you know? And in that little minute, you've given them something to think about for the rest of the day. That's part of our right to not remain silent, too.
Well, as always, I mean, I've already stolen that, wow, I see things so differently phrase from me. Yes. Now I've got the birds are being awesome. The humans are a mess. So thanks for that. Brian, I so appreciate you taking time. I know you're a busy man. There's lots going on. Is there anything else you want to say to your UK listeners this time?
First, I want to say congratulations to all the people who are so smart and wise and good that they listen to your podcast. That's fantastic.
Yeah. That's a given.
second, I want to say I'll be a green belt this summer, so I hope I'll get to say hi to many folks there.
Well, I hope so too. Brian, thank you so much. As ever, it's been an absolute delight to have you on the podcast. We really appreciate it. Please keep up the great work, my friend.
Same to you, my friend.
Well, that was Joe talking to Brian McLaren. I thought a really fascinating interview. There's so many really good and memorable bits. I do want to question one bit straight away, though.
Okay.
How do we know the birds are awesome? They might be complete, utter... We don't know that. We might have been blithely listening all these time to bird songs, thinking that it was beautiful stuff, and they might all be racist. We don't know.
It's a very interesting point. I love it, and that's a phrase I'm going to steal. But you know that other phrase that he mentioned that I have stolen many times. Wow, I see things so differently. Is a really great phrase to use when you don't want to get into an argument, but you don't want to let something pass. It's really, really good phrase. Highly recommend that. And I'm now stealing the birds are awesome and the trees are awesome, or even the sea is awesome. But yeah, that's good stuff.
I could hear you almost when he said that. I could hear you sort of expand in joy. I thought, Joe is so going to love that.
I know. My heart leapt for joy inside
your little
me.
Heart went pitter-patter.
It did go pitter-patter.
As I said at the beginning, he's such a good phrase maker. But I thought the bit right at the beginning, I was expecting the kind of thrust of this to be, how do we deal with it? Well, we deal by focusing on something else. But instead, he went straight in and going, you're basically exhausted by denial. Denial is exhausting.
It's a fascinating thought, isn't it?
And you've got to face it. And I thought that, I really, that made me sit up. I thought, this is true. This is amazing. This is a point where Ecclesiastes is coming into its own as the most important book of the Bible.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Its time has come. And yeah, I thought there was so much good stuff. I really like the stuff about as you breathe in, you're breathing in all the oxygen the earth provides and thinking about
that. Wasn't that wonderful? Yeah. Yeah.
And actually, the bit that really struck me was the idea that our enemies are systems of power, principalities of power. Yeah. It suddenly, that made real kind of sense of that passage.
That's, it does.
I'm pretty certain that's not what Paul meant, but it doesn't matter really, because I think that's how that's how I can read that and think about that now. He's right, our enemies are not individual humans, but the systems that that really work there. So what's the big takeaway for you? Because those are just some of the few things for me. But for you?
Well, all of those points. And also, I think just sort of in terms of, you know, the climate's not ganging up on us. We don't have a climate problem. I like this idea. The climate has a human problem. We're part of the, you know, the climate isn't damaging us. We are damaging us. And I think that's that's quite an important, perhaps obvious, but a really important distinction to make as we go forward from sort of this point, I guess. So I think there was that. And I loved the whole, just the whole tone of it. It feels like a very grown-up conversation. Its time has come. We need to get our heads around this. We've got to be talking about this stuff. And I sort of like the fact that he's not really mincing his words. I do think that comes with age and maturity. I think it's just time to say things like they are. And you perhaps don't, I guess you get to a stage where you're not even trying to protect your ego or do all that stuff anymore. Just say it like it is. And I think he's got there. And I think it's going to be a really good book. It's going to be a tough book, but a good one. I really commend it to everyone. Please do, you know, pre-order your copy. It's out, I think, on the 12th of May.
Well, I was so impressed that I have actually pre-ordered the book.
Wow.
And I don't order people's books on the grounds of jealousy, normally, and just bitterness. But I thought he was great. Yeah, he was very outspoken, and I like that. You know, it was kind of no shilly-shallying, no kind of trying to, you know, that phrase about when you're only interested in what you want, you're basically a fool.
Yes.
You know, that's Proverbs in a nutshell, basically, actually. But, you know, but pretty outspoken. So great. So thank you for doing that. We'd love, obviously, to hear what you've got to say on these issues. Do get in touch. And how do people get in touch with us, Joe?
Well, they would point their email machines to joe@midfaithcrisis.org and send us an email. We try and get through them all. I try to reply to them all. So it'd be lovely to hear from you. What do you make of that interview? That would be great.
We'll pick up on some feedback next week, and I'll talk a little bit about the article. Thank you to everyone for listening. Thank you to those who support the podcast. I mean, you know, we might not have that much longer left, according to Brian McLaren, in which case you could make two elderly men their lives more comfortable in the end times by supporting the podcast. And you could do that by going to our website and donating there. And remind people, Joe, remind people what they get if they are a supporter of the podcast.
Yes, well, if they want to give, I mean, we recommend, you know, the price of a cup of coffee a month. If you want to do that, £2 or £3 is great. And in return for that support, you get our gratitude. Nothing else. But if you raise that amount to, let's say, £5 a month, we like that even more. You get nothing. For £10 a month, you get access to, well, you know, Nick's bin, I suppose.
The contents thereof, yes. You get nothing. You get nothing. Yeah. Nobody gets anything, basically.
No one gets anything else. No, we're just grateful for anything. So thank you.
But remember what St. Brian said. If you're only interested in what you want, you're a fool. So, you know, don't be a fool and donate. Anyway, well, that's enough hard sell, I think.
That was very hard sell. Well done. You're getting bolshier in your old age.
Yeah, I know. I'm taking my cue from him. Anyway, thank you so much, everyone, for listening.
Thank you.
We'll be back with you next week. And remember, human beings are what they are, but the birds, apparently, are always awesome.
Always. Thank you.